I don't know how the hell you got past me, I said. Capone came walking over to my car all bloody. Somebody must have hit him with a bottle. Police were pulling up. So he took his blood-stained shirt off, wiping the blood off his face with it and tossing it to me before the cops saw him. I threw it into the bushes and gave him a fresh t-shirt from the car while more gunshots were fired from the pit. My cousin Stobo and his girl ran over and we jumped into the car and pulled off. On the way back to drop Capone off in the projects, we drove past this kid Moan from QB pedaling fast down the side of the Grand Central Parkway on an NYPD mountain bike. In the Shook Ones video, Moan was riding in the passenger seat while I'm driving the Saab across the 59th Street Bridge. He must have grabbed a bike while the cops were cuffing everybody and made a smooth getaway amid all the excitement. This nigga's on the Grand Central Parkway riding the NYPD mountain bike. Wow. Later that night, we crashed to Hempstead. Money Nose, Stobo, and I were sitting around my kitchen table talking and watching the news when clips of the Survival of the Fittest video flashed on the TV screen. Then, footage of all the bullet holes in cars at the pier parking lot and the shell casings on the ground. The news reporter called it an infamous boat ride. We were open. Our yacht party actually made the news. A couple of the dudes who got their heads cracked open with that pole tried to sue us for their hospital bills and pain and suffering a few months later. Niggas kill me. They act thug, and then when they get whooped out, they try to sue you? Shit is pathetic. A month after that yacht party, we did a show at some small club on West 20th Street in Manhattan called 20 West. Another new group, the Lost Boys from Jamaica, Queens, was also on the bill to perform. They were supposedly some gang who started rapping and had a semi-hit record called Lifestyles of the Rich and Shameless. Of course, the whole 12th Street crew came with us. Even if we didn't invite them, the whole hood would show up and get mad if everybody couldn't get in. I never understood that. If nobody invited you, how could you be mad if you can't get in? I was extra drunk. Some girl climbed onto the stage and was dancing in front of me while I was performing. Who the fuck is this jumping on the stage acting like a fool? I felt that she was disrespecting our show. So I kicked her in the back and she went flying into the crowd. I kicked the shit out of her. I was bugged out back then. A big muscle-bound bouncer was standing in front of the stage ice grilling me. He must have been upset because I kicked that girl. After the last song, I jumped off stage and punched him in his mouth. He started pounding on me. I was so drunk, I didn't even feel his punches. My man Bumpy from QB helped me fight him. And then more bouncers surrounded us. Next thing I knew, all the bouncers were jumping us. Knocked to the floor, I looked up and they were carrying Bumpy up in the air while dragging me outside by my shirt. They dropped Bumpy on his head and pushed me to the curb. After that, we tore that club up, all 30 of us. We broke the windows and all the mirrors behind the bar. As we was walking back to the train station to go home, we saw like 40 dudes walking towards us from the 23rd Street train station two blocks away, loudly chanting, "Lost Boys, Lost Boys." So we started chanting, "Mobb Deep, Queens Bridge," and it was inevitably about to be a Royal Rumble. Already hyper from the club, we walked straight up to them. Capone set it off, pulling out a razor and cutting the closest nigga across the face. Niggas was getting stabbed, hit with metal garbage cans, no gunfire though. A police riot squad pulled up. Suddenly we all stopped fighting each other and started fighting the cops so we wouldn't get arrested. Garbage cans was flying. Some of the Lost Boys got stabbed. Everybody fighting everybody. And someone started swinging the long blue wooden police barricade. Hav and a bunch of us ran to the train. But a lot of niggas got locked up that night. On a train ride home, two white boys were standing on the platform with bloody faces. They said that a bunch of black dudes had just jumped them and cut their faces up. Wow, everybody was wilding that night. Now that I think about it, It might have been the Lost Boys. To this day, my people from Jamaica tell me they heard about that fight. Some say they saw the Lost Boys come home all bloody that night. It sounds like a scene from a movie, but it was real. Steve Rifkin informed us that we were banned from performing in Manhattan for 2 years after that 20 West show. We were getting into too many fights and destroying clubs, so somebody with power banned us. We never found out who it was, but that bullshit ban didn't stop us. We were still doing shows worldwide. Our music was on fire all over the map. We didn't know our music would affect people's lives the way it did. It made us work hard to keep that feeling going. We saw people dressing like us, talking like us, even drinking like us. They tried to make beats and rap like us. A lot of people started using Infamous and attaching it to their name. I wasn't feeling that. Get your own shit. Get off of my pole. Even Biggie started calling himself the Notorious after that. I wonder where he got that idea from. Chapter 6. Hell on Earth. Store-bought rap ain't shit. My category is that of an insane man who strike back. I draw first blood, it's over with, and that's that. G.O.D. Part 3. Life was hectic when we were young. The night after the 20 West brawl, the whole 12th Street crew was on the block drinking, smoking, joking, and playing dice. A chick from the hood came walking by with a dude who wasn't from QB. He was a slut everybody ran through, so the crew started calling her over. She came, and my man Karate Joe met her halfway. The dude she was with didn't look too happy about this and kept his distance. Joe spoke to Shorty for a while, and the kid got frustrated and told the girl to hurry up. "Yo, mind your business," Joe looked over and told him. The kid said something slick back to Joe, and about five of my boys responded by walking over toward him. The kid acted like he had heart, walked over to us, and exchanged more words. Then the kid reached in his pants and pulled out a gun. But he was so nervous that he dropped it on the ground between him and Joe. Everybody paused. Joe looked down like he wanted to reach for the gun, but it was closer to the kid. Kid reached down quick, picked it up, and everyone hauled ass. Had ran top speed into a pole and bust his forehead open. I wanted to run from the bench where I was sitting next to the kid, but I couldn't because I was too close. He'd definitely shoot me if he sees me get up and run. So I just sat there. He squeezed the trigger at my boys, but the gun was jammed from being dropped. He scrambled to fix it and looked over at me and pointed the gun in my face. My adrenaline was going crazy. I wanted to run or duck, but something told me just to be still. The kid started squeezing the trigger towards my face, but the gun still didn't work, so he ran out the projects. Everybody came back to the benches. "Yo, why you ain't run?" my boys asked. "He was too close. If I ran, I would have been the last one," I said. "I would have been the one shot in the back." After we laughed it off, I went upstairs to lie down because my sickle cell was acting up. I thought I was about to get shot in my face. Shit. I thought I was about to die. I took about 6 Advil and went to sleep in Haz's room. After a few hours, loud shouts from outside woke me up. When I looked out the window, the 12th Street niggas was beefing with some niggas from another block. Some tall dude kicked Noy in the chest and knocked him down. Karate Joe walked over and everybody backed up. Nobody wanted to fight Joe. He was a boxer and he knew karate. He and Yammy were our secret weapons. The argument spilled on the 10th Street, and from the window, I had the best seat in the house. Trip, aka Godfather, chased some guy around the car 20 times with a knife. Noy cut someone across the face with a razor. The next afternoon, the nigga who Noy cut shot Noy 3 times on 12th Street, right next to the hill. Bullets in his leg, arm, and middle finger. Noy wanted us to put out his solo album, but we didn't have our own label or money to sign and promote him properly. We told him to have patience and it would happen soon, but he didn't listen. He got Karate Joe to manage him, and they started shopping for a deal without telling us. We were upset, but Noid explained that he had bills to pay and couldn't wait around for us to get a label deal. We understood, and we let him go. After Noid got shot up, fans, radio stations, and magazines were all talking about it, amazed that we were living the life that we were rapping about. Feeling all that fake love from people boosted Noid's ego and made him want to be a star on his own. You know how that story goes. Like when 50 Cent first came out and nobody gave a shit until he got shot and almost died. Fake love. A few months later, Noid landed a deal at Tommy Boy Records. He helped him with the production. He dropped Episodes of a Hustler and sold a disappointing 30,000 copies. But the streets loved Noid. It could have been way bigger than it was. The original plan was for Havoc and me to convince Steve Rifkin to give us our own label, Infamous Records, and sign Noid and the whole crew, the Twins, Ty Nitty, Godfather, and Gotti, plus Chinky, a female R&B singer who was Harlem Hustler Alpo's niece. No one had patience, and we all needed money, so we split up with separate plans. Havoc and I were mad at Noid, though. Mobb Deep was responsible for making him a star, so he should have stuck it out with us. Right after Noid's album was released, he got locked up for shooting his kid 3 times in the stomach for messing with his baby moms. It happened right in front of his building in Queensbridge, and the police were looking for him. I told him to dye his head blonde and wear a fake nose ring for a disguise. We all laughed at that one. It wasn't funny when Noid got caught and sentenced to a 1-3 year bid. Tommy Boy dropped Noid. We kept his name alive by performing his verse from Give Up the Goods at all the shows. Yo, it's the RAPPERNOYD. Niggas can't fuck with me. The crowd chanted his verse along with us word for word. In August 1995, The Source magazine hosted the second annual Source Awards at Madison Square Garden. We were cool with the owners of the magazine, so we got a bunch of tickets and the whole crew went. I even brought Kiki. I'd always tell her that it was too dangerous to come out with me, but I wanted to bring her along and make her feel good. We all got drunk and high and went inside and took our seats. Havoc and I were presenting the award with Wu-Tang Clan, so we kicked it backstage with them in the dressing room. Hav was so bent that he fell asleep on the floor. Kiki and I walked back to our seats to watch the show. In the middle of Biggie's performance, Hav came into the crowd screaming,
"Somebody took my fucking chain, yo! Somebody fucking robbed me, son!"
We jumped up to help him find his chain. Come to find out, Raekwon saw Havoc drunk on the floor in the dressing room and took his chain off his neck so nobody else would snatch it. Ray pulled it out of his pocket and gave it back to Hav, and we all calmed down. Def Row hit the stage and did one of the illest shows ever. Their stage setup had jail cells that opened up one by one as they performed Stranded on Death Row. After the song, Snoop Dogg started screaming on the mic.
"New York ain't got love for Snoop Doggy Dog. New York ain't got love for Death Row."
I sat there wondering, what the fuck is he talking about? He was really feeling himself because of all the money and power they were displaying on stage. But he took it a little bit too far. All the hooping and hollering made Snoop sound real stupid and left a sour taste with everybody from New York. After Death Row was done, Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang hit the stage to present an award. When we went back to our seats, Suge Knight, the co-founder and CEO, all the hooping and hollering made Snoop sound real stupid and left a sour taste with everybody from New York. After Death Row was done, Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang hit the stage to present an award. When we went back to our seats, Suge Knight, the co-founder and CEO of Death Row Records, came out in a tight red shirt and tight-ass pants with his ass crack hanging out the back. He started dissing Puffy, talking about how he dancing on his artist videos and how niggas should come to Death Row.
So all you artists out there who don't want to be on the label with the executive producers all up in the videos, all up on the records, dancing,
Suge shouted,
you come to Death Row.
After Suge's little hatred speech, Biggie took the stage to perform and won the award for Best New Artist. The new year passed. During the summer of 1996, sitting in my grandmother's house, I drew an idea for a pendant to go with my chain and brought it over to my man Manny in Midtown Manhattan's Diamond District. He did custom work for rappers way before Jacob, David, and all those other guys. Manny loved my drawing, a miniature Mac 10, about 6 inches long and 1.5 inches thick, all solid gold. Make it so I could take the clip in and out, I requested. He charged me $5,000, and it was the illest piece ever made in the history of rap jewelry. The only pendants that could compete with mine before or after were Run DMC's miniature gold Adidas sneaker, the first sneaker pendant, Ghostface's giant Versace head, the biggest pendant ever made, Big Pun's giant tombstone, the heaviest chain and pendant ever made, my platinum and Marquise Diamond infamous records piece, the first pendant made with Marquise Diamonds and the first 40-inch long chain, Nas's giant platinum QB piece, and 50 Cent spinning platinum G-Unit, the first pendant that could spin. Jewelry was a bad habit, and a competition as far as I was concerned. If you couldn't compete, then put your chain in your shirt when you come around me, cause I make your little bullshit look stupid. Some people hook up their car. Some people were heavy in the designer clothing. My thing was my 16 bars and my jewelry. Towards the tail end of the summer, we chilled in Queensbridge, taking a break from all the touring and recording. Havoc and his crew loved basketball, NBA and college. They were real serious about it. Every day, they played for money on the court in front of Hav's building. They all played on school teams when they were younger. Ty Nitty and Twin Gambino were the best. In the honeycomb hideout, I sit on the couch. Well, they were all excited, and I didn't even know what the hell they were screaming for. They tried explaining the game, but I just wasn't into it. When they played on Hav's block, I'd sit on the bench and try to learn the rules. I never got into any sports because when I overworked my body, it triggered my sickle cell pain. One of Havoc's close friends from Queensbridge, Ron Artest, played for the St. John's University team. Anytime his games was on TV, we made an event out of it and hit the honeycomb with a bunch of weed, liquor, and beer. Ron was real good, and everyone was hyped that he was going to be in the NBA soon. In autumn 1996, almost half the 12th Street crew went down to North Carolina to get out of New York for a few months. Most niggas went down south to hustle, but Havoc, Twin, Gotti, Godfather, Nitty, and I were there for a vacation and to get our driver's licenses for the first time. We couldn't get them in New York because of our driving records. The DMV computers weren't connected back then, so my New York record didn't show up in North Carolina, and the test was way easier down there. We got them in one day. Down south, they got something you won't find in New York, Southern hospitality. Girls moved us into their homes, cook for us, let us drive their cars, and a whole lot more. Mobb Deep was real popular in the South, so we had it extra easy. We loved the Dirty South. Havoc's homie Star from Queensbridge, the one who paid for the studio time for our demo, had moved down to North Carolina and was doing well for himself. He had the streets on smash and opened up a few strip clubs and nightclubs in Fayetteville and Greensboro. Havoc, Rondo, the twins, Godfather, Nitty Gotti, and I were all living in a small two-story shack on Juniper Street by Duke University in Durham. Star paid for us to perform at one of his spots in Fayetteville. It was packed. After the show, we were so drunk that Twin Gambino and I fell asleep in the spot. When I woke up in the morning, Twin Gambino and I were laying on the carpet in Star's office in the studio. Where's everybody? I was disoriented. Why am I on the floor? We were locked in the club with no way out. Yo, Twin, wake up, I said. Where's everybody at? He didn't know either. Neither of us had a cell phone, so we just had to wait. Luckily, the club was huge and had pool tables, video games, and a kitchen with a freezer full with French fries and chicken, so we fried up some food. After our meal, we turned on the DJ equipment, went behind the bar, mixed some Seagram's gin and orange juice, our favorite drink at that time, and played a few games of pool. 5 to 6 hours later, Star, Havoc, and the rest of the crew came back for us. They said they tried to wake us up the night before, but we were both out cold. Twin and I reminisce about that night for years. Around that time, this new truck came out, called the Tahoe. It was a Chevy dealership right by the house in Durham, and I finally had my license. It was time to buy my first brand new car. Gotti and I went to the dealership, and right away we saw a black Tahoe with gray leather seats that we liked. This badass saleswoman worked there, brown skin, real pretty, with a big, dirty South fatty. You know, we went straight to her. She took us for a test drive, and after 2 minutes, it was sold. Impressed that some young black kids from New York would have trucked that fast. She gave us her phone number and told us to come chill with her later. We did. My man Dude was making scrambled eggs for breakfast the next morning when Snoop and the Dog Pound's New York, New York video came on TV. These niggas was in the video, stomping all through New York's landscape and kicking over our buildings. Rondo, Gotti, and I immediately looked at each other and said, these niggas is trying to play us. First Snoop was flipping at the Source Awards, and now this? It was time to get back home. Right before Christmas, we made the 10-hour drive back to New York. Havoc bought a green Chevy Blazer from the same spot I bought my new Tahoe. We drove back to back. We had been in North Carolina for 3 months, the longest Havoc and I ever spent away from the recording studio. We immediately got started on our next album. The first song we made, LALA, featured Capone and Noriega, and was aimed at Snoop and the Dog Pound. Marley Marl made the beat, and we shot the video a week after we recorded it. We blocked out a few months at Access Recording Studios in Manhattan, next to the famed nightclub, Studio 54, and stayed there 24/7 making a new album. After The Infamous had so much success, Havoc always let me choose the names for our albums. I'll leave that up to you, P, he said when I asked for his input. You good at the album title shit? I came up with a good, strong name, Hell on Earth. While we were recording at Access, DJ Premier and Lil Dap and the Nutcracker from Group Home started hanging out at the studio a lot, smoking blunts with us while we worked on our music. Lil Dap was laid back, and Nutcracker was literally a nut. Our engineer, Mario, didn't like us smoking cigarettes in the control room. He'd get pissed off and scream, "Would you guys please take the smoke outside?" Mario was a good engineer, so there'd be like 10 of us smoking Newports on the balcony. A big pair of binoculars on the balcony brought us directly into the high-rise apartment windows all around us. We saw naked women, couples fighting, people having threesomes, all kinds of stuff. The studio management complained to Mario and Steve Rifkin at Loud because we left cigarette butts and Philly blunt guts all over the floor and spilled beer and liquor everywhere. We tried to clean up our act so we can complete our album. After pulling a late session one night, Havoc, the Twins, Little Dap, Nutcracker, Ty Nitty, Gotti, and I left the studio around 3 a.m. Havoc and I were the last two to come down to the lobby. And when we got off the elevator, we saw Nutcracker sitting Indian style on the lobby floor, clutching the studio bathroom air freshener can in his hands. We looked at him like, okay, and left the building. The next day on our way to the studio, we got a call saying that somebody in our session the night before took a shit on the carpet. We started cracking up, but the studio wanted to ban us from coming back. The only person who seemed capable of taking a shit on the carpet was Nutcracker, but we never found out for sure. Lil Dap and Nutcracker were our homeboys, though. We got love for them, whether Nutcracker did or didn't leave a pile of shit on the studio carpet. One of Premier's friends told me that one day, Premier let Nutcracker use his car, and he brought it back crashed up pretty bad. Nutcracker didn't mean to crash it, but when he had to face Primo and show him the crashed car, it hurt him so much that he pulled out a 9mm and shot himself in the foot to show Premier how sorry he was. That incident happened in the hometown of Group Home in DJ Premier, Brooklyn, just in case you were wondering. Yeah, Nutcracker was bogged out. L.A. quickly started getting airplay across the country. The press turned a rap battle between the Dog Pound and Mobb Deep into an all-out coastal war with the East and the West. Tupac had just signed with Death Row, and when he heard L.A., he decided it was time to prove his loyalty to his new camp. Pac put out a song called Hit 'Em Up, going at Mobb Deep, Biggie, Nas, and Jay-Z. Somebody in QB played it for us on a little boombox outside. Yo, Pac is dissing y'all, son. It was cool, but he couldn't fuck with us. Why the fuck is Pac coming at us? It took me a minute to figure out why he was dissing us. Then it came to me that he just signed to Death Row and Snoop was his label mate. So Pac decided to take it upon himself to jump into the drama. That night, we went straight to the studio and recorded Drop a Gem on him, going right back at Tupac. My rebellion, retaliate, I had a whole New York State aiming at your face. Got 100 strong-armed niggas ready to rock your shit. Clocks tick, your days are numbered in low digits. You look suspicious, suspect niggas is bitches. You chopped up, grade A meat, something delicious. We were the only ones to make a comeback song. Biggie made his little jokes about his wife Faith Evans having Tupac's, but that wasn't a war song. And Nas and Jay-Z, well, I guess they just decided to fall back. Jay-Z wasn't even popular yet. He had only one single out with Foxy Brown called Ain't No Nigga. It was weird that Pac targeted him too. There was tremendous tension in the air. All of Queensbridge was ready to ride with us, and I'm sure Pac had plenty of soldiers ready to kill for him. We talked about it on the benches on the block every day. It would have been a mess if we ever crossed paths. Pac bumping into Nas at the MTV Awards was nothing compared to running into us. Nas was like the older wise man, Mobb Deep with the little niggas you can't control. There wouldn't have been any talking. Tupac started doing interviews displaying his hatred towards us. In one of his interviews, Pac spoke about the time him and his crew bumped into Mobb Deep in Atlanta and how they had us scared. When I heard that interview, I didn't know what Pac was talking about.